There was ice on the prime meridian and ice on the rigging of the broad-beamed barges down on the busy Thames. Skippers marked the time and tide and set their oxblood sails against the north-east wind. A freight of iron was bound for Whitechapel Foundry, where bells tolled 50 against the anvil as if time were running out. Time was being served behind the walls of Newgate Jail and wasted by philosophers in cafes on the Strand. It was lost by those who wished the past were present and loathed by those who wished the present past. Oranges and lemons rang the chimes of St. Clement's, and Westminster's division bell was dumb. Time was money in the Royal Exchange, where men passed the afternoon diminishing their hope of threading camels through a needle's eye, and in the offices of Holborn Bars, the long-toothed cog of a master clock caused an electric charge to set its dozen slave clocks chiming. All the clerks looked up from their ledgers, sighed, and looked down once more. On Charing Cross Road, time exchanged its chariot for buses and cabs in urgent fleets, and in the wards of Barts and of the Royal Borough, pain made hours of minutes. In Wesley's Chapel, they sang, "The sands of time are sinking," and wished they might sink faster. And yards away, the ice was melting on the graves in Bunhill Fields. In Lincoln's Inn and Middle Temple, lawyers eyed their calendars and saw statutes of limitation expire. In rooms in Camden and Woolwich, time was cruel to lovers, wondering how it got so late so soon, and in due course was kind to their ordinary wounds. Across the city, in terraces and tenements, in high society and low company and in the middle classes, time was spent and squandered, eked out and wished away, and all the time it rained an icy rain. At Euston Square and Paddington, the underground stations received their passengers, who poured in like so much raw material going down to be milled and processed and turned out of moulds. In a Circle Line carriage, westbound, fitful lights showed the Times had nothing happy to report, and in the aisle a bag spilled damaged fruit. There was the scent of rain on raincoats, and among the passengers, sunk in his upturned collar, Dr. Luke Garrett was reciting the parts of the human heart. "Left ventricle, right ventricle, superior vena cava," he said, numbering them off on his fingers, hoping the litany might slow his own heart's anxious beating. The man beside him glanced up, amused, then shrugging, turned away. "Left atrium, right atrium," said Garrett beneath his breath. He was accustomed to the scrutiny of strangers, but saw no reason to court it unduly. The Imp, they called him, since he rarely came higher than the shoulders of other men and had a loping, insistent gait that made you feel he might, without any warning, take a leap onto a window ledge. It was possible to see, even through his coat, a kind of urgent power in his limbs, and his brow bulged above his eyes as if it could barely contain the range and ferocity of his intellect. He affected a long black fringe that mimicked the edge of a raven's wing. Beneath it, his eyes were dark. He was 32, a surgeon with a hungry, disobedient mind.